You know that saying, a dollar doesn't buy as much as it used to? Yeah, that's still true. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today, the fifth day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So how many times do you suppose have we used the phrase strong dollar on this program over the past year or, you know, couple of years anyway? Regular listeners will know, or you should if we're doing our jobs right, that the answer is many. The dollar's rise, as we have told you, has been great for Americans traveling abroad. But it's not so great, as we have also told you, for American companies that are trying to compete overseas. Could be, though, that this moment of the strong dollar is losing some steam. Over the past month or so, the greenback's given up about half of its gains for the year. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going with what is going on with the dollar and what it might mean.
Part of why the dollar has been so strong this year is because the Federal Reserve's been raising interest rates, making U.S. bonds more attractive. And to buy U.S. Treasury bonds, you gotta have dollars. But the Fed's likely to slow down its rate hikes. Chuck Tomes is at Manulife Investment Management.
Other central banks potentially will be hiking rates a little bit more than is expected, which will be beneficial for those local countries' currencies relative to the U.S. dollar.
A weaker U.S. dollar could help all the big multinational companies that sell a lot of products overseas. Catherine Dominguez is a professor at the University of Michigan.
Manufacturing companies that are selling abroad and competing with foreign manufacturers may find that they are able to do better with a less strong dollar.
Some American exporters are already benefiting from the weakening dollar. Take the ag sector, says Naomi Bloom, senior market advisor with Total Farm Marketing.
We saw an uptick with U.S. soybean export sales. Corn exports are actually behind a little bit, but I can't help think that we'll start to see that uptick here soon.
On the other hand, a weaker dollar makes imports more expensive. That isn't great for American companies that rely on imported goods, says Teresa Fort at Dartmouth.
Let's think about certain computer and electronics manufacturing, where a lot of the inputs come from overseas. You know, those firms might be relatively worse off as they see the cost of those inputs go up.
And higher input costs can be a drag on a company's productivity and employment. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday. So, you know those days where there is good-looking economic data and the stock market says, no, that's not good. Yeah, this was one of those. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Back when the pandemic was first hitting, we saw a whole bunch of cracks in this economy get a little bit, or in some cases, a whole lot bit wider. The instability of state unemployment systems, for instance, which were overwhelmed by all those people losing their jobs. How much we all depend on entire categories of workers, first responders, grocery store workers, to name just a couple. How we depend on them to make everything go right for the rest of us. Also, how widespread food insecurity is and how so many people are so close to the edge. That last item is where we go now. Claire Babineaux-Fontenot is the CEO of Feeding America. Claire, it's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me back.
We have talked, I don't know, like three, four times over the past couple of years since the pandemic started about the state of hunger in America. And I wonder, 2.5, 3 years on now, heading into yet another holiday season, what is the state of hunger in America right now?
Well, things are still tough. There are tens of millions of people who continue to turn to the charitable food system for help. We try to do the things that we can to be helpful. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a perfect storm still, where we have less food available through federal commodities. We have, it's far more likely today that our member food banks have to go out and purchase food, and there's still inflationary pressures on the food that they go out to purchase. There are supply chain challenges. So again, it's tough, but man, I'm really proud of our network because no matter how tough it gets, they stick with it. And I hope that your audience will stick with us.
Obviously, you and the food banks who are part of your network, your organization, depend on philanthropy, which through the pandemic has been reasonably strong. I do wonder, though, about the government support that you get. There was a White House conference on hunger that we talked about last time you were on and you were going to go. I mean, do you believe you're getting the government support that maybe you would wish to have?
Well, we certainly are not getting all of the support that we need. I feel good about the fact that for the first time in over 50 years, the country decided to pause and really ask some important questions about why is it that people are hungry in America and what is it that we might do to change the trends that we've been seeing. Even going into it, we knew that solving hunger would not be one day, one event. It would be a journey. And I think we have a good sense of direction on what needs to happen next. And the key is that we stick with this and go do the things that need to be done.
Yeah. So what needs to happen next, Claire?
Well, there are a number of things that need to happen. We need to think about things like SNAP, formerly known as food stamps. We need to make certain that when people get access to these federal nutrition programs, that they're providing people with enough resources to actually make a difference in their lives. There's a role for the public to play in not allowing this issue to be the thing we used to talk about, but instead to stick with it until we get some meaningful, sustainable progress made. And there's certainly roles to be played for people inside of communities who experience hunger. One of the key I would call it an epiphany on my part coming into the not-for-profit space was how often well-meaning people in philanthropy think they have the answers and that what communities need is for them to come in with a black box with a suite of answers. I think a vibrant role for communities to play in charting their own courses and coming up with their own solutions and being provided with the resources they need. So that's a lot of stuff, but it is a lot. Well, but I think we have to be comprehensive in the way that we look at these challenges.
Well, look, it's a big problem. So one hopes there would be lots of stuff. Last question, and then I'll let you go. You mentioned meaningful and sustainable progress. What does that look like to you?
This year, I spoke about an aspiration for the whole country that we as a country could decide, and we have the wherewithal to make it happen, that by the end of this decade, that food security rates were cut in half. So at the time I was speaking, food insecurity rates were at 10%. They'd never been beneath 10% since the USDA started recording them. Surely as a country, we can get it to 5 or less by the end of the decade. There are certain communities who have been inordinately impacted by food insecurity, and the gap keeps widening. Communities of color, rural communities, especially in the South. So we propose that we come up with plans that reduce the inordinance, if you will, the disparities in food insecurity by half by the end of the decade, too. So that's what it looks like to me. Making meaningful, sustainable progress by the end of this decade is doable. We have to choose to do it, and we have to roll our sleeves up and get it done.
Claire Babineaux-Fontenot, she is the CEO of Feeding America. Claire, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you taking the time again.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
American farmers seem to be having a pretty good year. That's the takeaway from the Department of Agriculture's Farm Sector Income Forecast that was out the other day. It says high commodity prices, among some other things, are going to push U.S. farm income up nearly 14% this year over last. And that is despite record increases in the cost of things like fuel and labor and other agricultural inputs, as they're known. Marketplace's Savannah Marr checks in on the farm economy.
Agricultural economists like Todd Keithy at Purdue look to the USDA's forecast for a snapshot of the farm economy.
the way that we think about things like GDP or unemployment, right? It's sort of being broad measures of the economy. This is one of the best measures of what is the financial health of the farming sector.
And it looks like that sector is faring pretty well. When you account for inflation, net farm income is still projected to grow by more than 7%. Bob Maltzberger at the University of Missouri says drought conditions around the world are playing a role. So is Russia's war in Ukraine.
With the limited access for Ukraine farmers to harvest all of their crop, as well as different disruptions for trade.
He says the global supply of wheat, corn, and soybeans has been tighter, driving up the prices farmers command for those crops.
That's good for farmers for this year.
The long-term picture could look different. Berent Nelson, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the forecast also found record increases in the cost of things like livestock feed and fertilizer.
We have that pushing our prices higher naturally from inflation.
And those rising costs tend to be pretty sticky and will stay high when commodity prices moderate. Plus, Nelson says farmers and ranchers do a lot of borrowing.
So when the cost of borrowing that money increases,
because of the Fed's interest rate hikes,
it definitely puts an increased burden on our farmers.
In the coming year, Nelson says higher borrowing and production costs could catch up with farmers, making it harder to maintain those profits. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
All right, bear with me here, but when you're getting ready to watch a movie, do you put on shoes or do you put on pajama pants? That's the question the studios are asking. There have only been 66 films out in wide release so far this year, down more than a third from where we were late in 2019. That's according to Comscore. Some movies have gone straight to streaming. Others have been available in theaters for only a week or so. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports on what it'll take to get more movies in theaters and more moviegoers back in real pants.
When the first Black Panther film came out in 2018, Janae Franklin went to see it with her mom and dad at a theater in Central Maryland. Last month, the sequel was released, so Franklin went with her dad. But her mom passed away last year.
So the head wrap that I wore was one of hers, so that in a way she could kind of go see the movie with us. So
Franklin says going to the movies is a big family pastime, and blockbusters like Black Panther are getting people out. It's brought in more than $700 million at the box office. Franklin says she'd be going to the movies more if there were more movies to watch. Take the film Disenchanted, which went straight to Disney Plus.
So if they had have released it in theaters, I more likely would have gone to see it in theaters, but they didn't, so I didn't have to go.
Studios are trying to predict what audiences want, and as a result are acting kind of unpredictable. Paul Dergarabedian is the senior media analyst for Comscore.
It used to be consumers knew if a movie is going in theaters, they knew the release date. They knew it would only be in theaters for about 90 days.
Most people do know what they want at the movie theater, to sit in silence or have a more communal experience. Sam Adams is a senior editor in the culture department at Slate.
The experience in your head when you think about being in a movie theater is always about an audience. It's about people, you know, cheering or laughing or jumping at a horror movie.
Adam says one way to draw people back is to release a movie in 3D, like the sequel to Avatar, which comes out later this month. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I love California.
Oh, but you know there's a butt coming right there, right? I love California, but first, though, let's do the numbers. Huh. The Wawas. I don't know. We'll see. You decide. Dow Industrial's down 482 today, 1 4/10%, 33,947. The NASDAQ subtracted 221 points, a little over 1 9/10%, 11,239. Okay, fine. 1.9%, the Wawa's. Okay. S&P 500 off 72 points, about 1 8/10%, 39 and 98. About 19 oil tankers are stuck in traffic jam as the $60 barrel price cap imposed on Russian oil by the G7, the European Union, and Australia takes effect. That's according to the Financial Times. They're waiting, those ships are, for permission to pass through Turkish waters to pick up loads of Russian oil. Sources told the FT the delays were down to Turkish officials checking the ship's paperwork to enforce the price cap. Following up on Savannah Maher's story, let's check in on some big ag stocks. Archer Daniels Midland ADM slipped 1%. The company announced today it expects its sustainable aviation fuel to be available by 2026. That'd be a big deal. Deere and Company, as in John, down almost 2% today. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.58%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are a very sports-focused nation. Sure, now it's the World Cup, but the Super Bowl, the World Series, the NBA, and NHL Finals, we watch them all. So it stands to reason that if given the right opportunity, we'd be just as into the sports we tend to overlook, like women's sports, perhaps. Jenny Nguyen agrees. She's opened a bar in Portland, Oregon. It's called the Sports Bra that shows only women's sports. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So give me the elevator pitch. You go to your investors, your potential partners, and you say, hey, here's this idea I have. What'd they say?
All the investors I went to in the beginning, everyone was like, it's a hard no. Three main reasons. One being it's a restaurant and bar during COVID. Two, I've never done this before. And three, no one had ever done this before. So that was like, we love this idea, but it is just way too risky.
Oh, but have a little faith, will you, people? I mean, look at women's sports, look at women's basketball, look at women's soccer, for crying out loud, right? That had to have been part of the response.
Sure. I mean, a lot of people were like, wow, we can't believe this has never happened before. But then, a lot of people also were on the same boat as what my dad's first response was, which was, there's probably good reason why nobody has done it before.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of hesitation, a lot of doubt. And, you know, it was really scary on my end, too, because, again, I had no idea.
I believe it was scary. I mean, you know, setting up a business has to be terrifying to begin with. But why did you feel you had to do this?
Oh, that's a great question. It just felt like there were so many places where traditional sports bars were missing the mark, particularly for folks like us. And I mean women's sports fans. I also mean non-binary or queer folks, because oftentimes those spaces don't feel safe. And then also, as far as the fear goes, it was really scary. And I was just like, I can just continue to live my life and everything would be fine. And this is just an idea that comes and goes.
But you couldn't do that.
No, right? I couldn't. I started to think about, if I were 9, 10, 15, 17, and if my parents brought me into a place like the Sports Bra as a kid, what kind of an impact that would have had on me. And when I thought about that, I was like, no, this has to happen, or at least I'm going to give it a shot.
I will tell you, I got a Slack this morning from a colleague who had seen this interview on Today's Rundown. And she said, I took my soccer-obsessed daughter to Sports Bra this summer when we visited Portland. Cool place. So your theory bears out in reality.
Yeah,
it's happening.
And what's fascinating to me is that there was a crowd that I was expecting. And I would say 80% of everyone that walks through that door is the crowd that I'm not expecting.
Oh, say more about that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I thought like I was filling a niche market for women's sports fans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that the Sports Bra really resonates with so many people on so many different levels. Oftentimes we'll get people who don't even watch sports, but they want to feel safe. They want to feel part of a community. And while they're there, maybe they get swept up in a little fandom.
Yeah. So here comes the all important question to the woman running a business. How's business?
Business is good. You know, we started out absolutely jam-packed. It was like opening the doors to a line and then closing the doors to a line, which, you know, in all of my research, I was prepared for the opposite.
Hmm. So look, what are the expansion plans?
Well,
come on, gotta think big, right?
Yeah. No, when I had written the business plan, I had thought about maybe a dozen major metropolitan cities in the country being a good spot for the Sports Bra. But now, after being open and having gotten just a lot of love from all across the globe, I'm having to kind of recalibrate my thoughts on expansion and or franchising.
Super quick, and then I'll let you get back to running your business. The naming and the branding, was it a no-brainer, or did you guys agonize over it with some, you know, branding consultant?
Oh, absolutely. It was a no-brainer. You know, my idea originally was just to have a sports bar, and all we were doing was changing the channel. And so that simple switch was what I thought of as a sports bar and a simple switch of two letters. And so once I said it, I was like, yeah, that's sticking.
Changing the channel. No, that's a good line. Jenny Wayne, she's the owner, also the founder of the sports bar up in Portland, Oregon. Jenny, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
The website Apartment List, which tracks average rent prices, says that nationally, median rent fell in November for the third straight month. That could mean relief at long, long last for renters all over the country, especially in the Sun Belt, where all the people moving in over the past couple of years has driven the housing market ever higher. So from the Phoenix metro area, here's the next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
My name is Taylor Naziah Jenkins. I am 23 years old. And I live in Scottsdale, Arizona. I grew up primarily in Cupertino, California. It's kind of the heart of the Silicon Valley. I remember slowly seeing everyone like leave. I remember especially seeing like the Latina, Latino, and the other African-American kids like that just dwindle every year I was in school. I love California, but it literally seemed like either I stay with my parents forever or I would have to leave. Staying in California did not seem like it wasn't an option. My friend, she texted me. She was actually living in Prescott Valley, Arizona at the time. But she texted me and was like, I don't like my roommates. Can you come live with me? I didn't know a thing about Prescott. I'm like, if California is this expensive and there's this many people somehow able to do it every month, Arizona has to be a cakewalk. And that's how I ended up here. My bills basically every month ended up being $1,000. And that was basically all I was making. And I was working close to 40 hours a week, commuting back and forth from Phoenix to Prescott Valley. And all I could make was my rent and my bills. And most of the time, I would actually DoorDash after work. So I was getting home at like 3-4 in the morning, trying to make ends meet. When I moved to Arizona, I remember this bumper sticker that I saw on someone's car. And it said, keep your California out of my Arizona. And I remember reading that and like almost laughing to myself because it's already here. The big issue among Californians was the influx of what we call transplants. So people coming in from tech companies to work there, and they can obviously pay a lot more for rent. I remember hearing the conversations my parents were having about rent and about where to go. And now, as a Californian, I see it happen here. But I need somewhere to live.
We want to hear your stories about finding and paying for a place to live. Share your adventure in housing with us, would you? You can do it at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, it's an oil and gas price doubleheader. OPEC Plus decided yesterday it is going to keep those production quota cuts we told you about a month or two ago in place. Remember, it's 2 million barrels a day that the cartel says it's going to keep off the market at about 2% of daily global demand. Catch is, a lot of OPEC countries weren't producing at their quotas anyway, so the actual impact is going to be quite a bit less. And quota cuts or no, AAA says the price of a gallon of regular gas right now is $3.40. That is down 39 cents in the past month, just a nickel more than it was a year ago. Here's your moment of economic context. This one is for the procrastinators among you, by which I mean me. The Department of Homeland Security announced today that it's pushing back the requirement that all domestic air travelers have those enhanced security real ID driver's licenses. First deadline, you might not know this, was 2008. 2008, not a typo. The most recent was May 3rd of next year. Now, we've got till May 7th, 2025. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.